Welcome to another Biology on the Beach. This is Dr. Leo Stouter. Today we're going to be talking about, let me just walk a little away from the beach here. We're broadcasting from beautiful Dania Beach. Today we're going to be talking about energy. And energy is going to be part of the circle of life. Our life depends upon energy. Energy comes from plants. And plants provide this energy through a process called photosynthesis. And we'll mention about this at length. Photosynthesis depends upon sunlight. Water and carbon dioxide in the presence of sunlight creates food. We eat the food, and therefore we have life. So you can see how the circle of life is dependent upon energy. And our energy is really going to be coming from plants. Ultimately, the concept of energy and plants is really going to be wrapped around the concept of the sun. So when we look at, for instance, water, and we combine it with carbon dioxide, we then get, if we have the presence of light, the presence of sunlight, then we get oxygen, we also get glucose, which is the food, and we also get a byproduct of water. So the general photosynthesis formula goes from water with carbon dioxide, which the plant gets from the environment, and then in the presence of sunlight we get oxygen and food plus some water. So when we breathe out our carbon dioxide, our plants are benefited, and when the plant in a sense breathes out, they're going to breathe out the oxygen. So it's a nice symbiotic relationship that we have. So life depends upon energy, and energy is defined as the ability to do work. There are two states of energy. The first one is potential. The second one is kinetic. There's two states, but there's three types. There's two states, potential and kinetic, but the three types are chemical, mechanical, and electrical. Now, the study of energy is called thermodynamics. Thermo for heat, dynamics for changes. So it's really going to be talking about heat changes. We can measure energy by using heat. For example, in a calorie, you know, you say you've eaten so many calories, that's the measure of the amount of heat that certain foodstuff would have produced. So if you take, for instance, a cake, and you put it in a machine that can measure how much energy is in that cake when you burn it, then you would know how many calories that cake would have in it. So that then would be what we would use for our energy. We would see how much energy is in this certain product, and then that would give us the idea of how much energy we could actually extract from that. Now we think of potential and kinetic states of energy, and then we think of the types. Well, we know as a little kid that matter can't be made or destroyed. So we heard that somewhere, and we're really not sure what it means so much as if matter can't be made or destroyed, that means that the Earth has the maximum amount of matter that it's going to have. There are three types of energy. So what we see is a transference of energy. So we can't make or destroy matter, but we can change that matter. We can go from chemical to mechanical to electrical, or from electrical to mechanical to chemical, or on and on. So we're going to be changing these types, if you will, of energy. We're still not losing it, but we are changing it. So when we look at the first law of thermodynamics, it's going to be what we just described, that energy cannot be made or destroyed. Energy can change, however, from one type to another. But the amount of energy in the universe remains constant. So we're not going to be getting rid of the energy, we're just going to be changing that energy. And the second law of thermodynamics is that energy goes from useful energy to less useful energy, as in heat. Heat would be less useful energy. And we call this process entropy. Entropy is where we go from useful to less useful. We buy a new pair of shoes, and eventually we wear them enough to where they're no longer useful as shoes. They have holes in them. So we got to get new shoes. Those new shoes, then, we can predict, will also go through entropy. As we wear them, they will wear out. As we were an infant, we were starting on our path to through entropy. Eventually you get older, and you go through the process of entropy. There's more and more disorder that occurs. And that's the way all life works. So these two concepts of law number one, energy cannot be made or destroyed. And the other law is that energy goes from useful to less useful. So we think of, for instance, in the car. We have our useful energy, and it's gas. So we put gas in the car, and it's going to be burned to push the pistons so we can move our car. So now we have a useful energy within the gas. We use that energy to push the pistons so we can move our car. The problem is that we create a lot of heat. So we have to have a whole system of dissipating that heat, or else the engine would blow up. So the idea of this heat, then, that's generated in our car is not useful, other than if we're in, you know, a real cold time, then we can use some of that heat to actually heat up the inside of the car. And that's useful. But most of the energy is not useful. That's going to be really heating up the engine. So that's going to be the example, then, of the second law of thermodynamics, going to less useful energy. Now, using the same analogy of our gas, if we pump gas into a car, that's going to be a type of energy. And that type of energy is going to be, of course, what? Mechanical, chemical, or electrical? It's going to be chemical, right? Because it's gas. It's a chemical. That chemical, then, will be changed by the car into mechanical. And, of course, that mechanical will be, it's going to move the pistons and it's going to move the car, move the wheels. Also, if we turn on the radio or turn on the windshield wipers or turn on the lights, we'll see that same energy is going to be transferred into electrical as well. So we got our chemical, our gas, that converts into mechanical and electrical. We did not lose any energy in any of this exchange, but we did have a change from one type to another. So when we look at energy states and types, one of the best examples of potential and kinetic, which are the states, is a closed safety pin. You think of a closed safety pin, it has the potential to boing, to open up. And when it opens up, it releases energy. You could open it up really fast and it could like bounce right out of your hand. So that is potential energy because it's coiled up. So when the safety pin is closed, it's coiled up. When we open it, it boings out, and that then would be kinetic. So kinetic would actually be the process of utilizing the energy source. As we said with our gas is potential energy. There's nothing going on with the gas yet. But if we burn that energy, or if we burn that gas, now it becomes kinetic energy. It's going to do something. So its potential, it has its potential in gas to fire and cause the engine to work, but it's just potential. Until it becomes actually burned, it's going to be then considered kinetic. Or if we look at the body, we can see that our nerves are positive on the outside, and this would be potential energy. If they change their polarity and actually cause a nerve impulse down the nerve, this would be considered the kinetic energy. We would have a negative on the outside of the nerve. So going from positive and negative, this causes a change in the nerve. This causes the nerve to actually push down. It's what we would call an action potential, which then will stimulate another nerve. So the nerve, sort of, shall we say, at a resting, has the potential to send down the nerve impulse. And if it does send down a nerve impulse, we call that then kinetic. Also chemical. We have alluded to ATP before, but now we're going to talk about it a little bit more specifically. ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. So we have a triphosphate chemical or molecule. So what we have is tri, meaning three, and phosphate, meaning phosphate, phosphorus. So we have three phosphate groups. These three phosphates are going to be combined with a high-energy bond. We've talked about bonds before. We mentioned that we have a covalent bond, and we have an ionic bond, a hydrogen bond. We didn't really mention the high-energy bond. That's what you're going to find between the phosphates and ATP. They're high-energy bonds, and picture them as being, if you picture a P and a P together, and let's say that they are pushed together by a spring, that spring would be considered to be the high-energy bond. If you let go of both phosphates, that spring will go boing, and that will let out its energy. So ATP is the potential energy. When you go boing and you lose one of the phosphates, you now go into kinetic energy, which is going to be considered ADP. And the D here stands for di, which is 2. So you start off with the potential energy being ATP, and then once that high energy bond is broken, you then have ADP, but with the added advantage of having that energy release. Very similar to looking at gas once again. Gas would be like ATP. You burn the gas, and that would be like ADP, and then you get your energy source. So that's really the differences between potential and kinetic, and then mechanical, electrical, and chemical types. When we think of energy, really, we think of it as something that's going to be facilitating our life. We know that. But it also is going to be very important for chemical reactions. So our energy is going to be really involved in chemical reactions. So when we start a reaction, we call the first part of the reaction an exergonic reaction. An exergonic is like exit is like outside. If you take an exit, you go outside. So this is going to be what happens on the outside of the reaction, if you will. Now, this requires energy. So right now, we're seeing that we need energy to do these reactions. And a classic example of a reaction would be that we want to have our energy being burned. Let's say we ate some carbohydrates. We want those carbohydrates to be burned so that we'll have energy to do what we want to do throughout our day. So how do we get this carbohydrate to be part of our energy source? Well, we have to break it down. We have to put it through a chemical reaction. And that's what we're talking about now. How do we allow these chemical reactions to occur? So what we have, first of all, is an energy source that causes the reaction. We call it activation energy. So this activation energy is the actual energy that is initially going to be used to cause the reaction to occur. Once the reaction takes place, all the subsequent reactions are called endergonic or inside reactions. Catalysts or enzymes have the capability of decreasing activation energy. So the net result is that you need less activation energy to start the reaction. So enzymes help our body to maintain a proper temperature because they, as we said, if we have too much energy, a byproduct of that could be heat. So if we use an enzyme to decrease our activation energy, the amount of energy we need initially, then we will have less body temperature, which is good. So our body temperature needs to be in a certain range, and we all know it's 98.6, right? Above that would be too high, and below that would be too low. So we're trying to get around 98.6. If we did not have enzymes or catalysts to decrease the amount of energy that we need to actually cause reactions, then our temperature would be too high. and that would be causing some problems, because we said that heat is oftentimes a non-usable source of energy. And usually it's not as what did we say last time? We said it's not as useful energy. It's less useful. So let's think of an analogy, a real good analogy. An analogy would be if there was a girl being pushed by a boy in a red wagon. So initially the boy would have to have a lot of energy. You can almost picture him sweating. And there'd be a lot of energy, and you'd want to push the girl up the little hill. And this little hill would be difficult for the boy to push, but nonetheless he would be using lots and lots and lots of energy. We have to call this then the exergonic reaction. That's going to be the outside energy that we need. Then once he pushes the girl enough up the hill, then the subsequent reactions are not going to require him to push her any longer. The subsequent reactions are going to be inside of the reaction, and we call these subsequent reactions endergonic. So you have endergonic reactions resulting from the exergonic reaction. Now if we think of the boy pushing the red wagon up a huge hill, that's going to take a lot of energy. That's also going to produce a lot of heat. What enzymes do is they make that hill smaller, so that you can use less energy initially. But the cool thing about enzymes is that they don't cause decreased endergonic reactions. So you have less energy being expended, but you don't have a downside, if you will, by having less endergonic reactions inside of the reaction. So enzymes or catalysts are really, really handy to have. And enzymes are all going to be proteins. So the body's going to be making these enzymes that are going to be assisting in our reactions in our body. So that's really what the enzymes do, and that's also what our energy does. Now another analogy that we can use is the loan analogy. If an individual wants to get a loan, they go to their bank, and they say, "I'd like a loan." The bank says, "Well, what are you going to give us?" And then you go, "What do you mean? What am I going to give you?" And they go, "Well, for us to give you money, you need to give us some money." And you go, "Wait, you don't understand. I want to get a loan. I want some money from you. I don't expect to give you money. Why would I want to give you money? If I had money, I wouldn't need to come to you." And the bank says, "No, we don't need all the money. We just need a little bit of money up front to start the reaction, to start the loan process. It's called collateral. So just give us a little bit up front, and then we'll give you the sum that you want." So that's what's going on in this reaction. A little bit up front, the exergonic reactants. So a little bit up front, we need a little bit of upfront energy. So that's going to be exergonic. And then after that, then you'll get your loan. You'll get more reactions afterwards. You'll get more money afterwards. But we need to have that initial push, that initial exergonic, to get the rest of our money, which in this analogy then would be the endergonic reactions. So that's really how the whole reaction system works in our body, and how our reactions in our body work, as well as how we're able to do what we want to do with our daily lives, is because of the fact that we have these enzymes and that we have this energy source that's also going to be utilized in our bodies. So enzymes help to speed body reactions. As we said, they're proteins, and enzymes have active sites where reactions take place. So there's actually a physical area on the enzyme where you'll have reactions taking place, and the substrates are the reactants. So we would have an area of the enzyme, and that enzyme would be the active site, and then we would have substances that would be in there, and those substances are called substrates. And then they would react, so the enzyme would serve as a reactant area, so that the reaction can occur. So in an enzymatic reaction, the enzyme assists in the reaction, but it isn't used up. So So it's not like it gives a piece of itself. It's just an area for the reaction to occur. So enzymes have as their first name what they act on, and the last part of their name is what they are, enzymes. So an enzyme always ends in A's, A-S-E. So the first part's always going to be what the enzyme acts on. The last part of the name is going to be A's, which tells you that it's an enzyme. So, for instance, lipase. Lipid, or lipid, is fat. So lipase would be an enzyme that acts on fats or lipids. We also have protease. Protease would be an enzyme that acts on what, do you suppose? Right, protein. So protease would be an enzyme that acts on protein. Cellulase, right, would be an enzyme that would be acting on cellulose, which is the roughage, if you will, or the fiber of foods. We also have amylase. You may not know that amyl is going to be starch. So amylase would be a starch, an enzyme that acts on starch. There's also, well, there's a variety of different ases, but anytime you hear the A's, you know that's going to be acting upon whatever it is in front, like, for instance, acetylcholine esterase. That's an enzyme that's going to be acting on who? Right, acetylcholine. Even though you may not know what acetylcholine is now, still you could figure out that that's an enzyme that has something to do with choline esterase, acetylcholine. So when we look at the active site of an enzyme, and let's use the example of the litter box. The litter box, if you do not clean your cat's litter box for a while, it'll smell like ammonia. And why is that? Well, that's because reactions are occurring in the litter box. Reactions occur everywhere, but this is especially a good example. In the litter box, what happens is that your cat pees in it, and your cat's pee is a waste product called urea, which is found in the urine. And also there's water there as well. It's going to be really transporting the urea. So you got two. You got water and you got urea. Now these two substances are going to be mixed and brought to the active site. These are called substrates. So urea and H2O, or water, are two substrates. They go to the active site of the enzyme, and the enzyme is called urease, for urea. It's an enzyme that's going to be affecting urea, right? Okay. So the enzyme is not changed. It's like a matchmaker, you know. They just put two people together and they don't get married. Just the two people get married. So the matchmaker never gets married. It just puts people together. So we have the enzyme that's not changed, but the reactants or substrates are going to be in the active site. What's going to happen is we're going to have a reaction here. And the reaction is going to combine the urea and the H2O. And the results are going to be ammonia is going to come off. And also, we're going to get carbon dioxide. Now, what we do not notice is the carbon dioxide. It just goes off into the atmosphere. But if you go to a litter box that hasn't been cleaned in a while, you will definitely smell ammonia. And that's because the urease in the litter box has done its job, its enzymatic job, which is to actually break down or cause a reaction between urea and water. So after the reaction has occurred, the enzyme now is available for more reactions. So when you think of the enzymatic reaction in your litter box, you have to go, well, how could I control this? Well, you'll notice here in Florida that if you have a real sunny, hot day, that your litter box will probably last less time than when it's colder out, because temperature has an effect on enzymatic reaction. It tends to increase it. So as you increase temperature, you tend to increase your level of reaction. So your enzymatic reaction increases. If you were to think about a steak, if you left a steak out in the sun, you'd expect it to rot pretty fast. Why is it rotting? Well, because of the enzymatic activity within the steak. How do you stop that? Well, we use a refrigerator, don't we? The refrigerator is going to have a temperature that's lower, and at lower temperatures, enzymes tend to be less active. So we can expect our steak to last longer and not rot because we've lowered our temperature. Another thing that can control temperature is pH. The acidity or alkalinity will have an effect on certain enzymes. So there are certain enzymes that are going to have certain pHs that they're more active in. And if they're going to be more active in certain situations than in others, this then can be a way for the body to control when the systems are going to be active or not. So for instance, in the stomach, we have an enzyme called pepsin. Pepsin is going to be very, very active in a very acidic medium. So it's going to be very active in the stomach. It, however, is not going to be very reactive in the lower intestine, because the lower intestine is going to have a higher pH. And pepsin needs a low pH to work. So the body controls pepsin working by keeping it just to the stomach. And when it passes into the small intestine, it stops working. So that's how we can control the enzymatic action. Another thing that can happen is there can be actual inhibitors. An inhibitor will actually inhibit the ability of the active site to be open. If the active site is closed, then the reactants can't get in. If the reactants can't get in, then the reaction will not occur. So this is another way of controlling our enzymatic activity. So if you think of a reactant trying to get into a smaller space that used to be the open active site, it's no longer going to be working. So we're not going to get the two reactants being able to have their enzyme assist in the reaction. A good example of this is a person who is lactose intolerant. A person who is lactose intolerant has inhibitors that have gone to their enzymes that take care of lactose, which is the milk sugar. And the enzyme is called lactase, which makes sense, right? Lactase, milk sugar. Or the enzyme that acts on milk sugar, lactase. Now, when a person reaches a certain age, if they're younger and they are taking breast milk, then they'll have active lactase enzyme, which will help in digesting that milk. But as they get older, they may get inhibitors. So they don't have less enzymes. They still have a good amount of lactase. The problem is that they have inhibitors that the body has sent them. So now their active sites are no longer open. So if they eat lots of lactose, their body's lactase, which is not working any longer because it has a smaller active site, now the person has a reaction, gas and bloating and those kinds of things. So that would be the best example of inhibitors as far as controlling enzymatic activity. So at a biological level, we find undeniable unity among all forms of life. And these undeniable sort of unity qualities are going to be that all life shares carbon. So all life shares hydrogen and oxygen and ATP. So all of life has these as their characteristics. So we say that carbon is the backbone of life. And we've talked about that before, where we have a carbon backbone of our carbohydrates, of our proteins, of our fats. So we have really as a backbone, and then we know that carbon likes hydrogen around. So that's why we call them hydrocarbons. And oxygen, of course, is significant for both plants and animals. Animals need oxygen, but plants need carbon dioxide that comes from animals that utilize oxygen. And also ATP is the universal energy source of life. So all life needs ATP to live. So ATP is going to be that universal energy of life. And ATP, as we've mentioned before, is a molecule that supplies the cells with their energy. that the universal energy currency. So it's as if we could say it's like a, you know, it's like a dollar bill. You can utilize it anywhere in the United States to buy stuff, and that would be like to get your energy. So ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. Adenosine is a nucleotide base, which is found in DNA. This is bound to three phosphates with high energy bonds, as we described. Once ATP expends energy, ADP is formed. So ADP is two phosphates. ATP is three phosphates. So ADP and one phosphate is called ATP. ATP is made from ADP by cellular respiration. So cellular respiration is going to be the way that we get our energy source, our ATP. Now, why do we call it cellular respiration? Well, really, when we breathe in and we breathe out, we call that respiration. So breathing in oxygen and breathing out carbon dioxide, that's really what we would consider our body's respiration. Or we call it pulmonary respiration, or the lungs are doing this for us. But if we are considering just the individual cell breathing, if you will, taking in oxygen and releasing carbon dioxide, then we have to call it cellular respiration. So this is happening on the cell level. So in cellular respiration, the cell is making ATP. And what is ATP? ATP is that energy source. So cells can get energy in one of two ways. Either they can do it without air, or they can do it with air. They do it without air, then it's going to give them less energy in the end result. If they do it with air, they're going to be doing it with the better result, getting more energy. So anaerobic respiration is without air, and aerobic respiration is with what? Is with air or with oxygen. So anaerobic without oxygen, aerobic is going to be without oxygen. So what we use in our bodies, usually, is aerobic respiration. And we're going to be talking about aerobic respiration in our next podcast. So thanks for listening to Biology on the Beach, and we'll be talking again. Bye now.